On the 21st of August this year, I shall reach my 79th birthday and therefore be in my 80th year. These past years of my life have been very full ones, embracing as they do two world wars and all the disruptions and havoc wrought by them. My parents lived in a tenement in Partick, Glasgow, on the fourth floor, so that my country-bred mother could see Ben Lomond. When I was born, it was still Queen Victoria's reign, and my mother used to tell me that I was taken in my pram to see the soldiers going off to the South African War, to the Boer War. We were in this house in Partick until I was about three, although I remember little of the place except falling down the stone stairs and getting a huge bump on my forehead, necessitating the application of a penny piece to reduce the swelling. We moved to a new terrace house in Scotston, then a growing suburb, on the main tram route to the city, where my father worked as an overseer in the General Post Office. He was the eldest son of a Presbyterian minister, who seems to have been a better carpenter than a preacher. When my brother William, named after the Reverend William, and I were old enough, we paid an annual visit to Stirling, usually in July, to Manse Crescent, where my grandfather had address my grandfather had retired. There at the foot of the garden was my grandfather's wonderful workshop, from which emerged wooden wonders such as a four-seater motor car and a wheelbarrow. The latter was used by my grandchildren. The former was the joy of the youngsters in Scotston. Four of us would get in, complete with parasols for the girls, at the top of a hill, and with a push off, we went faster and faster until we reached the bottom, unless we were couped out on the way down. My brother and his friends were motorbike fiends in their teens. Our garden had always a tent erected in it in the summer and was the rendezvous for the children of the neighborhood. We went to the local school, both of us. I well remember my first day when I was 5 years old, being confronted by a class of some 60 children and asked by the teacher if I knew anyone. "Yes," I said, after a good look round, "I know Jack Maitland." "Well," said the teacher, "you can sit beside him," which I did, making an enemy of him for life. When about 11, I went to Hamilton Crescent School, Partick, which, after a year, moved to a new school at Hindland. I cycled each day backwards and forwards, even for lunch, in all weathers, passing the White Inch Park, where the petrified forest was discovered, known as the Fossil Grove, millions of years old. We holidayed in the West Highlands most years, my grandfather Brown accompanying us. It used to be a great thrill to have the West Highland train stopped specially for us at Aracher at some unearthly hour in the morning for our journey to Connell Ferry, Loch Etive. One day the train was late. The general factotum, inquiring of the engine driver the cause, received the astonishing answer, "Oh, we had a bit of trouble with fish in the tank." My grandfather Brown, a retired headmaster, loved asking questions. On one expedition with him along a Highland road, we met a local youth driving cows and calves. Calling the latter in Gaelic and the former in English, my grandfather, inquiring the reason, was given the answer, "Well, mister, you see, the calves hinna learnt the English yet." This grandfather retired to a house on the banks of the River Leven. The back gate opened onto the towpath, along which I often walked with him before breakfast as a wee lassie. He once walked me the 2 miles by the river's side to Alexandria to see my and his first movie, silent one it was, in the town hall. It was pearl white in a hair-raising thriller, jumping from trains, etc. I well remember standing on a plank at the back of the gallery, as excited as my old grandfather, watching this new wonder. In fact, there have been so many new wonders in my lifetime. I well remember seeing my first motor car and the first aeroplane. This was in Stirling during the first air race round Britain in pre-war days, I suppose 1912 or 13. Even the cows and horses raced around the fields, much disturbed by this strange creature in the air making such a din. Stirling still had horse-drawn trams, which to ride in was a great thrill to us. Then in 1914 came the Great War. Our teachers disappeared one by one, leaving us with most inadequate substitutes. Then as the war dragged on, our boyfriends left for the front, many never to return. The devastating call of the newsboys, "Special! Casualty list's latest," was heard incessantly. Thank goodness I didn't know RLM until university days, which started for me in October 1918. The summer vacation after leaving school was spent by me in a factory, the Albion Motor Car Works, which, like other works, was turned over to munitions. As I was too young to do this munition work, I was given a job in the finished parts stores department, my first introduction to the world of industry. I was even allowed to distribute the morning's letters to the bosses of many departments. University life was grim in 1918. Especially when a severe flu epidemic struck us. But on the 11th of November of that year, the armistice was declared. News came to us at Queen Margaret College, where we were at a physics lecture, which we promptly left and rushed downtown to celebrate the great news. That evening saw a torch-like procession of students and others move through the crowded streets of Glasgow. Some of us found ourselves in the mob at the central station and later in the gallery of a theatre. Such rejoicing and such chaos and such sorrow for the men and women lost. On the 11th of November 1919, we saw a wonderful assembly of ex-servicemen as well as students in the Butte Hall to remember with 2 minutes silence those killed in the 1418 war. We had 100 women and 400 men in my year. We all struggled along to qualify as doctors, 5 years of it at that time. Then the great day came when one did at last pass one's final and was duly capped. Of course, there was lots of fun and games during the process. We played hard and worked hard and paid our way as best we could. My parents could not afford my class fees, so I had a Carnegie interest-free loan of £90 to help towards expenses. This was paid back in full some years later. Your father paid his expenses out of his war gratuity, which was greater as a sub-lieutenant than that he received as a lieutenant colonel after the Second World War. Then came the day when we went down and sorrowfully left all our university friends. I came to Wolverhampton and worked as an assistant to my uncle William Brown, doing my round of visits on a cycle. I got to know how people lived and worked in this busy industrial Midland town. Then we decided to get married and settle down in Wolverhampton, where we have lived and worked very happily for over 50 years. At first we lived in a wee rented house in Woodfield Avenue, but after 5 years there and the arrival of two children, we moved to a Georgian house in Penrose, Springfield House, where we consulted in the afternoons and had casualties on our doorstep from time to time. This abode was a three-story old-fashioned house with a large enclosed garden at the back and a yard where we had many bonfire parties with jack-o'-lantern, turnip lanterns hanging in the row of poplar trees, as well as Halloween games like ducking for apples in the kitchen and fancy dress parties in the lounge. Two more children were born here amid great rejoicings, especially at Christmas when we had splendid parties. Then came the Hitler menace and the awful year of appeasement before the Second World War was declared. Off went the old warrior to join up in the RAMC. After sad partings, he sailed for the Middle East via the Atlantic with all the submarine hazards and escorts of warships round the Cape to Cairo, where Rommel was advancing menacingly. The Nutcracker Suite, that is the head injury unit, was the one to which RL was attached at first, but as this unit went into the desert campaign, he was ultimately sent to a hospital at Sarafand near Jaffa. We at home learned this from a code we had devised in a letter for the Middle East. At home, we struggled along with rationing of everything, including petrol, for which we had coupons. As I was doing a wartime job as factory examining surgeon, I had plenty for use only in the town radius to enable me to attend concerts in the town hall. I used to visit the men on the night shift in factories. The dangerous trades like plating chrome, etc., necessitated fortnightly visits and inspection of workers. Chrome ulcers of the nose were common, as well as of feet from leaky gum boots. Goodyear's black shop was one of the places I used to visit. "You can't come in here, miss. It's too filthy," said a worker to me once. "Why not?" I replied. "If you can work in it, I can come in." Conditions in some factories were deplorable, for example in pickling shops and ceradizing, both treatments of metals to prevent rusting. Still, people worked with a will to see the war finished. We ran a canteen for soldiers, seven women of us forming the management committee, being responsible for a day each. My day was Thursday, on which I ran three shifts of some 20 helpers in each. We had lots of Dutchmen as customers, owing to the fact that the centre for the Dutch Army was in Rotsley Park. Then came the United States into the war, bringing lots of GIs of all types, from cowboys to niggers. These were busy days, what with domestic affairs, school journeys, works visits, council meetings, court and canteen work. I was so tired some nights I went to bed after I had tucked the children in at 8 p.m. On the town council, I served as a wartime co-opted member for 2 years on health, education, art gallery committees, as well as doing all my magisterial work. In 1936, I had been appointed a Justice of the Peace for the Commission of Wolverhampton, and at that time was one of the youngest members of a bench, and I served until 1971 in various capacities as chairman of the juvenile court, involving attendance weekly as well as petty sessions on Mondays. I also served in the 50s on an advisory committee at the Home Office on the training of probation officers. I was particularly interested in the work of the probation service and was very pleased that after much struggle we managed to get a living wage for them. The difficulty was that the new social service officers of this particular variety had been upgraded to such an extent that their salaries exceeded those of the probation officers. At one of our annual meetings, we had the Home Secretary present, and we insisted that if he didn't bring the salaries of probation officers up to those on a level with the social service officers, that the magistrates would no longer be responsible for the running of the service. This was one of their duties, to run the probation service and to see that it was well and truly staffed. Feeding the family was a difficult task. One Christmas I was perturbed about the menu, but was assured by Mrs. Barber, who looked after our consulting rooms in Bath Road in town, that she could supply me with a chicken, which she was rearing on the kitchen hearth from a day-old chick. So we managed somehow until the joyful day when Father came home, only to go off to Norway for the rehabilitation of Russians in captivity in hospitals run by Germans, who had by then withdrawn from Norway. VE Day followed amid great rejoicings and much relief. Bombings in the Midlands had been fierce on Coventry and Birmingham, Wolverhampton becoming a dormitory for these places. I did examination work for the General Nursing Council before and during the war, and well remember arriving at the Queen's Hospital in Bath Row the morning after the first landmine had exploded nearby. The work of the hospital and the exams went on, although the staff had been on duty all night dealing with casualties dug out of the destruction caused by the serious raid. Wolverhampton sent water on several occasions to Birmingham and Coventry when water mains had been damaged by bombs. Post-war years brought problems of schooling and university education and ways and means of meeting them financially. Still, once the breadwinner was back at work, consultations brought in more each year and we managed. In 1953, the coronation year of our Queen Elizabeth II, we built a new house on Pattingham Road, on an acre of land we had bought for £1,000 after the war. We ultimately got a permit to build to limited specifications, and finally, after 9 months gestation, our house was completed and we moved in. By the way, the building of the house cost £6,700. Such a joy for us to have a house with such an extensive view and a garden to cultivate. In December 1953, Sheila was married to a fellow architect, and we entertained the party at Strathnava, as we did again in December 1955, when Mary married a fellow medical. In 1958, Murray, after graduating BSc at Birmingham, went on £100 on a world tour with his cousin Rogan, reaching Persepolis in Persia and coming home to Strathnava, both of them with beards, Murray's black and Rogan's red. Next year, 1959, Sheila went to United States of America with her new babe to join her husband, Peter. In 1961, RLM retired from the National Health Service, and that autumn we left on the Queen Mary for the USA and California, returning on the Queen Elizabeth in April 1962. We went to Mexico on this trip, visiting the pyramids at Chichen Itza and Uxmal. In 1963, September of that year, we were again in the United States for the joyful celebration of Mary and Judith's marriage in the garden of her parents' house in Boston. In 1965, we did a world tour, visiting Bangkok, Hong Kong, China, Peking and Canton, and Japan, and on via Honolulu to San Francisco to be with Sheila and her family. It was fascinating for us to see how the people of other lands lived, especially those in the Far East. In Peking, all was quiet and peaceful, as it was not until the next year, 1966, that the Cultural Revolution broke out, when all was chaos again. In the spring of 73, we again visited Sheila in California and came home through Canada, visiting various distant relatives in Vancouver, Regina, and Windsor. Then, on the 6th of June, 1975, we celebrated our golden wedding with a party of 100 old friends and relations at Pettingham Village Hall, the catering being ably carried out by our competent daughters-in-law, Sheila, Alan's wife, and Judith, Murray's wife. Mary came from California to be with us, and Sheila later in October joined us for a wonderful holiday in Crete. In May of 1977, we attended a gathering of the clans in Edinburgh. 200 Mackays foregathered from the ends of the earth at a dinner. Your father wore his kilt, borrowed back from Alan for the occasion. The booklet that your father has composed over the years on the history of the Clan Mackay was duly launched at this function and has caused considerable interest, especially amongst overseas members of the clan. After the function in Edinburgh, each clan dispersed to its own home ground. We went to Sutherland via the lovely Strathnaver Valley to Far, where the Chief Lord Ray opened a Mackay Museum in an old 18th century church. At Mary's invitation, we spent Christmas 1976 with them in Tasmania. We flew out on the 22nd of November to Singapore, where we spent a couple of days enjoying the sights of the old and new city of Singapore. We then continued our flight to Melbourne and over to Wynyard, where the whole Kill family were on the airfield to welcome us. We had a 2 weeks trip to New Zealand, visiting correspondents at Wellington, Fielding, Dannevirke, and in the South Island. It was fascinating to see the vast farmlands with thousands of sheep and cattle, and to meet Mackays and Murrays who had emigrated from Scotland last century. We flew home in one long, wearisome flight via Melbourne, across Central Australia to Hong Kong, Delhi, and Frankfurt. And from February onwards, we were involved with Jessie's declining health until her end on the 26th of September. In October 77, we were joined by our daughter Sheila on a fascinating trip to Sousse in Tunisia, where we enjoyed the colorful sights in the towns and villages and the Roman remains at Carthage, Duga, and El Jem. Christmas we sent with Murray and Judith and the children in Birmingham, joined by Alison over from Tasmania for her first visit since emigrating from Hull 4 years ago. She's now a graduate, BA, with honours of Hobart University. Alan and Sheila celebrated their silver wedding anniversary in November 76. Alan has been a reader in crystallography at Birkbeck College now for some years and travelled abroad a lot, visiting other universities, giving papers and attending conferences. His family, all now grown up and looking forward to the future after university courses, Robert at York, Andrew at Trinity, Cambridge, and Claire, after studying at London Polytechnic, is now a married woman with a little babe. Murray works away at his engrossing task as a reader at Birmingham University on road accident research. He is now a worldwide authority on this important subject and attends conferences in Europe, Australia, United States to discuss ways and means of making roads safer for all users, cyclists, pedestrians, as well as motorists. We too continue in our quiet way, enlivened by visits from members of our family and our 9 grandchildren whose future development we watch with the greatest interest.